1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio with a 21st Century Perspective on History's Greatest Rock Album. I'm Redbeard, and today we test drive the 1985 Rush model that was fully loaded, including power windows.
The album is about power, power of big business, of money, power of governments, power of love, an emotion detector, power of dreams. Nobody thought of power windows because it just sounded too silly.
We thought that Time Stand Still was a great candidate for having a woman's voice, and we'd heard, you know, a couple of Till Tuesday songs, and we decided to get in touch with Amy Mann, and she said, yeah, I'd love to do it. The innocence
lives away. Hi, this is Geddy Lee of Rush.
Hi, this is Alex Lifeson of Rush in the studio for Power Windows and Hold Your Fire.
You've no doubt heard the now overused phrase, be careful what you wish for because it just might come true. Well, the Toronto-based trio Rush found out that it's not just a cliché after many years, albums, and tours, when in 1981, the album Moving Pictures became an international hit, selling multiple millions of copies. Already veterans at touring, Rush was forced to play arenas and even try stadiums. The mixed reviews by longtime Rush fans to the follow-up album Signals and the lack of a hit from the follow-up to that called Grace Under Pressure, plus the aborted leap to stadiums, it was all looming in the Rush rearview mirror when the intrepid trio went in the studio for 1985's Power Windows album, according to Rush singer, composer, multi-instrumentalist Geddy Lee.
Well, you know, it's funny. Grace Under Pressure always seemed at the time to be a very guitar album to us because we were thinking guitar all the time. You know, we would write parts on keyboards, and then we'd go, well, this should be a guitar part. Let's transpose it. And I think what happened was we didn't have a fresh enough perspective. We were in the right direction, but we didn't have a fresh enough perspective. And I think a lot of the guitar parts, even though there are a lot of guitar parts, they don't seem to have the same dynamics they should, and they don't, because the songs are lacking in dynamics and the sound of the album Grace Under Pressure is sort of a darker sound. I don't think you appreciate what is really there, how much guitar there really is there. It's dynamics of sound. It was a conscious desire of Peter's to put more space in our music, to appreciate some of the things that are going on. Like he said, he thought there were times in our past music where there were so many ideas going on that they were clogging each other's ideas, and instead of, you know, highlighting a moment of the song, it was doing the opposite. It was almost imploding because there was so much information going down. So it was more of a balance of time sharing between instruments. You know, a friend of mine made an interesting comment. I hadn't seen this friend in a while. Today he said, you know, after listening to Power Windows, I understand Grace Under Pressure more. And, yeah, he seemed to think that he could see the direction of Grace Under Pressure now a lot clearer, having seen that we finally arrived there, you know, and gone back, which I had never thought of before.
We'll be right back. Big noise from those Rush boys. Big money exploded off the 1985 Power Windows album. But the lyrics sound like a Bernie Sanders presidential campaign song from today. Big money from Rush and Power Windows was a big hit in 1985, and Neil Peart's lyrics seem, if anything, even more evident now. Geddy Lee said that Rush tried to be honest but fair.
Well, it's not all a bad look at big money. I mean, it's a sort of a half-hearted attempt to be objective, but I mean, in the end, it probably says a little more bad than good, but that song tries to be an objective look at the power that big money wields, whether it be good or bad. You know, the power to change people's lives without them knowing it, the power to move the world in a positive and a negative way, and in all different parts of the world, which is why the lead off to every chorus is big money goes around the world, and try to make it, you know, not just Wall Street, you know, in an international, in a total sense. So it doesn't always point the finger in a bad way, but...
How has big money changed your life, Geddy Lee?
Well, it's made me less desperate, I guess. Our lives are affected by, you know, big money and big government and all those kind of things in many ways. Me and you and everybody who's around. I've been fortunate enough to have some success in my life, so I've been able to buy a bit more freedom with that. And I think that's really what it represents to me. I can't pretend that I understand what it's like to be struggling anymore, because I don't. It's been a long time since I've had that kind of struggle that most people talk about. But, you know, there are different kind of struggles. I mean, whenever there's anyone successful, nobody wants to hear about their struggles because they're successful, you know. Don't tell me you got problems. You know, you got lots of money, that kind of thing. But there's enough things out there. There's enough, if you care to maintain yourself as a real person, you know, like, and be concerned about real things, then there's enough out there to keep your head screwed on straight, I think, you know. And I think that's how you have to deal with it. You know, you have to maintain your personality and work hard at keeping real things in focus.
Rush wrote a song on Power Windows right out of the pages of history called Manhattan Project, which was the secret code name for the invention of the atomic bomb.
Manhattan Project was the code name, the committee that was set up to develop the atomic bomb. It was originally conceived in the early stages of the war, but didn't really get going until the middle of the war. And of course, the bomb didn't get developed till the end of the war, which in effect did end the war. Their offices were in Manhattan, which is why it was given the name the Manhattan Project. But and a gentleman by the name of Leo Szilard, who was a Jewish, I think Hungarian scientist who had escaped from Europe during the war, the early stages of the war. He was in charge of that aspect of it. There was one team that was working in Chicago. It's an interesting story. Leo Szilard wouldn't go to Los Alamos where the rest of the scientists were because he refused to leave Chicago and all his delicatessens and stuff like that. He thought it was uncivilized to live in the desert with a bunch of scientists. So that's why a lot of that work was done in Chicago.
You just can't get a bagel and cream cheese out in the middle of the desert.
That's right. He just wouldn't go. So, but Robert Oppenheimer was the head of the committee and the man who is largely responsible for making sure that it got, the job got done. And Enrico Fermi and Edward Teller and a host of others. Imagine the land where it all began.
Amazingly, Geddy Lee sings poignantly about the creation of the most terrifying weapon of mass destruction, and somehow Rush stops short of condemning the scientists who developed it.
No, you can't really. It's impossible because you can't put yourself back in time and imagine what it was like to live during that time and under the threat of the other side maybe having the same awesome power.
They actually thought they were going to save hundreds of thousands or millions of lives by developing this weapon.
Sure, and who's to say they didn't?
Right.
You know, it's a very controversial argument and almost impossible one to win, for either side to win. But, well, I'm glad you picked up the more tender side of the story. But when we decided we were going to do this song, we didn't want it to be, you know, this war, bombastic war story.
Uh-huh.
We wanted the angle of the song to be about the people, the project, the scientists. You know, we wanted to point out that these were not evil men. These were not bad guys you know, washing their hands in all this radiation and trying to do something horrible. And people all over the world were trying to do the same thing. It wasn't just bad Americans. That's something that often gets, you know, pointed to when talking about the bomb, that it was Robert Oppenheimer's fault and it was the Americans' fault. But it was a big British effort that actually convinced a lot of people to start the project.
There was a big German effort. There was a big Italian effort. Obviously,
Japanese effort,
right,
you know.
The people that were involved.
It was a race. Yeah. It was a race.
Yes.
And the Americans won the race. And at the same time that it's a sad thing, you know, it's something to be proud of that they actually accomplished. It was an amazing thing to accomplish. But, you know, the results, I don't think there's a single scientist alive today that was on that project that doesn't regret what he did in one sense or another and has to live with that, you know, what the result of their efforts did. But at the time, there was no choice. They had to do what they had to do.
Up next, Geddy Lee and Alex Lifeson explain the intended symbolism by the use of Power Windows as the album's title. Check out In the Studio on Facebook, tweet Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and visit online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Geddy Lee and Alex Lifeson about to join us on the anniversary of the Rush million-seller Power Windows.
Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Geddy Lee of Rush.
Hi, this is Alex Lifeson of Rush in the studio with Redbeard.
Well, it's a sort of a strange combination of images, you know. It's actually two ideas that sort of stuck together. We want, the album is about power. A few of the songs, most of the songs on the record deal with different kinds of power. You know, the power of big business, of money, the power of governments, power of love, an emotion detector. Yeah, the power of dreams, you know, on and on. So we wanted to have that in the title somehow, but all the titles sounded so corny, you know. Went through so many. And also we wanted something to reflect the point of view, the observation point or the window. You know, at one point we were going to call the album Windows, but it sounded too jazz-like, you know. Mm-hmm. So nobody thought of Power Windows because it just sounded too silly, you know, at first. It sounded like a joke. And the more we thought of it, the more we liked it because it was different. It, you know, it sounded like such an ordinary sounding title, you know, Power Windows. What is that? That applied to the album graphics that we were planning and to the material on the album, it all seemed to balance itself out and give it more weight than normally would have had. One thing that Peter really stressed to us on this record is how much more dynamics the guitar can have, the role the guitar can take. And we really took that to extreme. We examined every guitar part inside out when making this record. What kind of sound should it be? How can we change the sound? Is this sound too heavy? Is this sound too light? And I think as a result, there was a fresh sound on every song. It's not the same guitar sound on every song. You know, where they're redundant are pulled back. And when they're needed to be guitar featured, they're brought up. So that when you're hearing the guitar when you're supposed to hear it and it's got a fresh sound to it. So dynamics, I think, and not being afraid to leave some spaces, to leave some holes, is really shown off a lot of the things that were always in our music, but because of one reason or another, not being focused.
reflecting the extreme endurance sports, cycling and swimming that lyricist drummer Neil Peart discovered in the early 80s, is the song Marathon by Rush on Power Windows. The fuller arrangements reignited a discussion regarding the possible addition of a new fourth member, at least for the live concert tours. Here's Rush guitarist composer Alex Lifeson.
It does from time to time, but not very seriously. I think at that time, with the release of Power Windows, it was something new for us. We did a lot more on a record than we normally would have, and we were afraid about being true to the record live. So we did talk about it, whether it was time to actually bring somebody on the road, and then decided, no, let's not disrupt anything. We'll work around it somehow, and we did. This time it was a little more difficult, but still we worked around it. And I tell you, those first 10 days in pre-tour rehearsals, you're going crazy. You know, everything sounds awful. First of all, you sound like a really bad copy band of yourself. Yeah, for starters. And then you've got to remember all of the pedals and all that stuff. But now, you can read a newspaper while you're doing it, and it's always like that. So I don't think we'd ever actually add somebody live. Yeah. Plus, being a three-piece for so many years, during a time where keyboards had not evolved, really, synthesizers, which are great space utilizers. They really take up a lot of space in the sound. We always had to do that right from the start. You know, I tended to play a lot of suspended chords, very broad chords, to fill more room. And, you know, the same with Getty's quick bass playing and Neil's very busy drumming. It just filled more area. So it was a good foundation for us. So I think we can really overcome any kind of obstacle like that. Besides, it's a challenge and it makes things more interesting.
Mystic Rhythms comes from the 1985 Rush million-seller Power Windows. Still to come, Alex Lifeson explains how all of this musical exploration by Rush in the 1980s culminated in A Girl in the Boys Club. Follow In the Studio on our Facebook page, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online 24/7 around the world at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Getty Lee and Alex Lifeson of Rush, Power Windows.
Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Getty Lee of Rush.
Hi, this is Alex Lifeson of Rush in the studio with Redbeard.
Appreciated, gentlemen. The subject of the passage of time informs much of rock's 21st century subject matter, including Rush's recent Clockwork Angels album and R40 tour. But it's certainly not new for Rush lyricist drummer Neil Peart, according to his bandmate, guitarist Alex Lifeson.
It was a theme that Neil was working with when we went in to write. And he just wanted to develop it further. Of course, he went off in tangents. He went from time as the central idea to instinctive second nature and time. So he really spread out from there. We thought that Time Stand Still was a great candidate for having a woman's voice. We sort of went through a list of potential singers. And there were a few people on our list, some very strange choices. Cyndi Lauper was on the list. We thought that maybe she would be right, but as the song developed in the studio, we realized that she really wasn't right. And it was not a concern about her character or the way she is. We were really looking for the quality in the voice. And we decided then that it was not really right for the song. We thought about Chrissy Hynde. She was not available. Or she wasn't interested or whatever. And we'd heard, a couple of Till Tuesday songs, and we decided to get in touch with Amy Mann. And she said, yeah, I'd love to do it. She came up. We spent a few hours just sort of chatting and hanging out and getting to know each other. And then we threw her in the studio and let her go at it. And after about, 3 or 4 hours, I guess, she finished it, really got, she was quite nervous at first, but she really got into it, and it worked out great, I think. Her voice really was perfect. She has the sensitivity that the part required, and we've become good friends since then.
catch my breath before I start off again. Living on without a moment to spend, to pass an evening with a drink and a friend. I let my skin get too thin. I'd like to pause, no matter what I pretend. Like some pilgrim who loves to transcend, learns to live as if each step was a year.
Time Stand Still was the surprise big hit for Rush from the Power Windows follow-up called Hold Your Fire in 1987. I asked Alex Lifeson if Rush could have opened up their musical box of crayons, inviting an outside female soloist into their tenacious trio on, say, Hemispheres in 78, or even Permanent Waves in 1980.
I don't think so. Why? I just don't think that we were in the right frame of mind for that. We were very set in our ways, I think. Although we tried to be influenced by as many things as possible, and we don't want like to be closed-minded. But looking back, I think we were busy trying to establish what the band was at the time. We were still searching. I think now, after 900 albums and, you know, being around for so long and being on the road for so long and knowing each other so well personally and musically, the whole process of recording and writing is different. You know, it's hard to explain it, but it just has a very different quality about it now. I guess it comes from experience, knowing that what you have in your head, you can easily translate without stumbling on performance or whatever. And what you say about the confidence, that's also key as well. You feel more confident and you can deal with ideas much quicker. So I think our writing is developed in that way. So we can approach things a lot faster. And a concept like having someone else sing on a record, I just don't think it would have made sense back then. Now, it's great. And I think Peter Collins has to take some credit for that. He's opened up our eyes to a few things. We were always very strict about what we did in the studio. We maybe picked one song and went crazy with it, overproduced it, knowing that we weren't going to play it live. Everything else had to be done so that we could play it live. With him and Power Windows, he says, no, you know, why don't you just make your record sound like you want it to sound? If you want to have these strings, or if you want to have a brass band, get it. Do it. Worry about it after. So we thought, okay, good idea. And then we tried things that normally we would never have done prior to Power Windows. Power Windows. Now, of course, we feel a lot more comfortable and confident that we can do whatever we want in the studio, and we'll figure out some way of doing it live. It happened so fast. I remember one of our earlier synths was the Oberheim OBXA. I mean, they were really happening. We paid $5,000 or $6,000 for those things. We couldn't sell them for a couple $100. I swear to you, we couldn't get rid of them. Nobody wanted to spend even a couple $100 on this thing.
They were so outdated.
Yeah, so outdated. We ended up just donating them to a college, a music course at a college. And technology is in such a state that that becomes increasingly easy every year. Or every week.
On the 1987 Rush album Hold Your Fire, Geddy Lee sings the Neil Peart line, "The innocence slips away." On the hit Time Stands Still, again, Rush guitarist Alex Lifeson.
Well, to a great degree, you try to hold on to that innocence, that the quality of innocence, because it's attached to spontaneity and in that innate instinctiveness that people have. And certainly when you're a musician or an artist or whatever, it's important to keep a portion of that as part of your character makeup. I think as you get older, certainly the innocence does slip away. The reality of growing changes, everything around you changes, your whole perspective on the way you view things changes. I mean, physically it changes. You don't look at things the same way as you did when you were in your teens or your 20s or whatever. Every year, there's a change in the way you see things. Musically, I think it's really important to try to keep a finger on that pulse and not lose it completely.
But I think with Time Stand Still, it's really just stop it for a sec and look around. Yeah, just take a little more time and appreciate the things that are around you. Friendships, things that are happening to you, experiences. I mean, I know a lot of people that still say, man, 1970, that was the best year of my life, you know, and we're not like that. The greatest years of our lives are the years that we haven't experienced yet.
And that's really the way we feel. We don't, you know, we try not to spend time lamenting the past, but try to absorb more and appreciate more the things that are around us. Often you get caught up in schedules, or you get caught up in routines, and you miss out a lot of the finer things in life. And before you know it, they're gone, and you can't get them back. So I think it was more of a cry of spending more time appreciating things. We'll be right back.
And now, in the studio, the lightning round with Rush. First, what about the constant overheated rhetoric and the politics of fear? Geddy Lee.
I don't feel that because, you know, somebody's an actor, that they have any more right to speak on a particular political subject than somebody else. They're an actor. They're not a politician. And they're whatever they're talking about, I hope that they're an expert in that area. I wouldn't feel comfortable speaking publicly about anything I wasn't an expert about. You know, so I feel very reticent to jump on bandwagons and start using my popularity as a political device to, you know, speak bad and good about a subject. Of course, I will. If something is bothering me enough, it'll come out in my music. As far as our responsibility, I don't think it's our responsibility. I don't think it's musicians' responsibility to talk about this stuff. But I don't think it's something to avoid either. I think if you're an artist that's concerned with issues, and if you are thinking about that particular thing or that which concerns you at that particular time, it's a natural expression for you to want to talk about it. But I don't think it's the role of an artist to have to do that. You know, music is entertainment, should be entertainment first and foremost. But there are those of us who need something else to chew on while they're doing that.
Corporate sponsorship of band tours? Rush guitarist Alex Lifeson.
We're lucky. We don't have to worry about that. We work really hard, and we tour not as much as we used to, but we still tour quite a bit, and we have a lot of expenses, but we've managed to stay away from corporate sponsorships because fundamentally we don't feel they're really right. The prostitution angle. I think that when you're on stage and you have a banner above the stage that says, you know, Joe's Hardware presents Rush, that would be really selling out. Now, I understand that for some people it's really important because they wouldn't be able to tour, they wouldn't be able to play their music, they wouldn't be able to exist without some kind of sponsorship. And in those cases, I understand it and I think it's good, but for us, we've never had to worry about that, so we tend to stay away from it totally. You know, offers come in, and they can be quite tempting, but I don't know. You feel a lot better the next day when you haven't done something like that. Yeah. Well, it's become commonplace, and people, I think, are quite used to it, but I guess we're old-fashioned in a lot of ways.
With Rush, there's no focus on one front man, no band member photos of faces on front covers of albums, no cult of personality with Rush, no celebrity. Geddy Lee responds.
You know, it's funny because in some circles that would be our drawback. People would consider that to be our main drawback. Yeah. You know, we're a hard band to get across, and we're one of our people that works in our management company warns everyone comes to work with us that, well, these are nice guys, easy to work with, except you just have to go in knowing the fact you have one of your arms tied behind your back when you're dealing with them. So we went through a period where we were very reluctant to focus on our faces, to focus attention on our faces. It just seemed like the wrong focus, like our music should be the focus and not our personalities, because people don't really know me. They don't really know Alex and Neil. So we just felt it was a bit of a charade to feed that machine.
But that is so anti-music business, and you realize that fully, of course.
Sure, absolutely. And it was a little impractical to be so defiant about that. And I think after a bit of time, we realized that it was no sense denying what we do. You know, we're in the public eye, and I'm up there on stage in front of, you know, 15,000 people. It's a high-profile gig, so you can't just run away and hide from those things. That's just part of the job. But at the same time, there's a way to do what you do and have that covered by whoever is covering you without hyping yourself. We all refuse to hype ourselves. We can't go, you know, to a radio station or you know, on television or to a magazine and sit there and try to sell ourselves. It just feels unnatural to us. It feels uncomfortable. But we do, we are proud of what we do, and we like to be seen as what we are and what we are doing. So we feel more comfortable being seen as performers and on stage playing. And
but collectively too, right?
Yeah. Correct, collectively or individually, you know, but as performers, as part of what we do, doing what we do. That's why you won't see us acting in our videos. You won't see us doing those kind of things, because it's just not what we do. So for us, even though we could probably get more mileage and maybe we could have our faces splashed all over all these magazines if we really wanted to, it's comfortable for us to carry on the way we carry on. It gives us more peace of mind and enables us to do our job with a clearer head. And I guess in the end, that means we do our job better. So that's important to us.
Why no separate limos or dressing rooms for Rush? Alex Lifeson.
But it's true. I think we are actually quite unique in a lot of ways from a lot of bands. We've worked with so many people over the years, and we've made some good friends, and we haven't made some good friends. Yes, and it's incredible some of the things that go down with other bands and their organizations and just the guys in the band, you know, the typical separate dressing rooms and separate transportation. And
you don't do that in Rush?
No, no. And
there's not five limos.
No, there's no limos. That all can be so stupid. And people tend to believe their own hype in certain cases. Well, I know a few musicians that believe they're as great as they think they are, and yeah, and they really play the part, and I don't know, it's kind of dumb, I think.
Creative self-loathing. Geddy Lee of Rush.
Truman Capote once said in a preface to one of his books that, you know, God gave him the talent to write and also gave him what he considers to be a whip that he uses on himself, because the better you get, the more you see wrong with you as well. And it's like, in one hand he's writing beautiful paragraphs, in the other hand he's whipping himself, saying that's not good enough. And I think most artists have that in them, that you're striving for perfection. You know, to quote another person, Woody Allen, he once said, you got to try real hard to make your art perfect, because it's real difficult to get that to happen in life, you know. It's hard to get all those things to fall into place. So you keep striving for perfection. And I think if you do strive for perfection and you accept the fact that you can always do something better, and maybe not better in the same way, but maybe better in a slightly different way, mm-hmm. that you can keep the fat wallet from eroding your spirit, and you can stay hungry and stay hungry in the sense that you can be artistically hungry without actually having to be starving, I think, as long as you have the right attitude about it. Of course, you can fall into the trap, you know, the tender trap. You can be complacent real easy, but I think being aware that that can happen to you and being scared of it is what keeps you motivated and keeps you driving. And I'm deathly afraid of that, because I grew up, you know, following so many bands. I was a big fan, you know, I loved all these bands. And one by one, they all disappeared and they all faded away and all got complacent. And I dare say that there's some fans out there that were fans of ours, 10 years ago, that aren't now, because they think that's happened to us, but only because we've had to move on to doing other things. But I don't think it's happened to me. And you know, I hope it never does. And I think all of us being aware of it and afraid of it keeps that razor's edge.
With the dawning of the 80s video age, the challenge of balancing celebrity marketing with privacy. Here's Geddy Lee.
Well, it's very difficult, I mean, adjusting to the video age for us, you know, because, you know, you look at all these new bands, and half the prerequisite for them being in the band is how they look and this, that, and the other. I mean, it's always been like that, and it's always been that machine. I mean, ever since, now more than ever. And because it's a new phenomenon, and a lot of young bands, unfortunately, think that that's more important than musicianship or songwriting. which is why there's such a lack of great songs in the last year or so. But it was difficult for us to adjust to it and get a perspective on, oh, how do we want to be seen? I mean, we've used, over the last 2 years, we've probably done 6 or 7 videos with 6 or 7 different directors looking for someone who understands what we're supposed to be. And I don't think there is any one person. I mean, what we are changes from song to song, and I guess that's why, you know, our video interpretations are so different from song to song. And actually, our videos, I'm sort of the intermediary when it comes to videos, like band videos for TV and for the live show. A lot of that stuff I do because I'm interested in film, and you know, I spent a lot of my formative years, you know, watching all night movies. So I saw a lot of movies, and I just really interested in. And when we first started doing things like that, we would hire directors and stuff, and I always seemed to have an opinion, so much to their dismay. And as a result, I just go to do it. I like doing it, and I just seem to have a lot of ideas, so it's a nice outlet for me to have a visual outlet. But I find the film industry, you have to have even more patience than the music industry.
That's
so.
What I hear.
Be very difficult to go into that kind of thing full time, but as something to dabble in, it's a lot of fun.
We'll be right back.
Rock and Roll Hall of Famers, Rush. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the Studio, thanking my guests, Alex Lifeson and Geddy Lee of Rush. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.